I thought for a while maybe long-form TV is cinema. It's not. It simply isn't. You know, it's a different viewing experience. You could look at three episodes, two, four, ten, you know, one week, second episode the second week. That's not... It's a different kind of thing. So there's got to be still, what has to be protected is the singular experience of experiencing a picture, ideally with an audience, you know. But there's room for so many others now and so many other ways, and there's going to be crossovers completely. The value, the value of a film that's like a theme park film, for example, the Marvel-type pictures, where the theaters become amusement parks, that's a different experience. And it's like, it's not even, I was saying earlier, it's not cinema, it's something else. You know, whether you go for that or not, but it is something else, and they shouldn't be, we shouldn't be invaded by it.
Welcome to another episode of Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim. And now, the man 4 out of 5 Bernie Bros recommend, Teal. How's it going, buddy?
Good, but I'm not even following up this joke. I can't go down that road.
But well, 4 out of 5 recommend.
4 out of 5 is pretty good. Recommend for what, though?
Well, just you as the person. That fifth one, he doesn't trust anybody who's not, you know, in 100,000% on the burn. He's got his defibrillators, and he's ready at a moment's notice.
This is why I wasn't going here.
I'll go there.
I understand that. Yeah.
And then, you know, I feel like we're always picking on the right. So why not pick on the far left?
Why not pick on the left, too?
Yeah, we're equal opportunity offenders.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey. I just don't want to get started, because once I get started, I probably wouldn't stop.
Because then you may lose one of those recommenders.
Exactly.
You'll go down to 3 out of 5.
Oh, might get worse than that. Zero that thing out.
Oh, geez. Okay. So listen, I have to address any listener out there who caught our last show on the Joker. Couple of things. And it's going to take a few minutes.
Wait, are you going into the gory details?
Yeah, okay. So, look, there was some audio issues, to put it mildly, on the last episode. And, you know, to reveal the curtain, sometimes doing this show and having guests come on and trying to make it all happen, it can be tricky. And you and I have kind of worked
out... From a technical perspective.
Well, yes. And you and I had worked out a system that for you know, better part of a year has worked pretty good. You know, we kind of started out one way and we got better. But having a guest come on the show was a little bit complicated. You know, you had some internet issues, namely a squirrel, it turned out, ate part of your internet connection outside.
A squirrel was chewing on my internet cable, and it was going out several times an hour.
And why is that important? Because to communicate for you and I to record, I know it's funny, but I get that. I get that you live in a rural area, and there's squirrels, and they're chewing away on the wires, and you don't even think about that. That's why the internet's having problems. You just think, my internet company stinks.
Well, that I was ready to switch companies, and then, you know, the guy came out and figured out the squirrel thing, and they were so great about it. I'm never switching companies.
That's great.
Yeah, they gave me a new modem. They upgraded. My internet is now like 5 times faster than it was before.
Which is actually allowing us to communicate an entirely new process today. And I'm not even going to get into what we used to have to do. but this is much better. the problem was we wanted to use this method last week when we invited our listener, Sarah, on the program. And then you were running into those internet issues and we didn't feel like canceling because we felt that that would not, you know, we invite her on and then we say, no, we're going to cancel.
Can't do it. Technical difficulties.
Yeah. I wasn't sure she was going to buy that, quite honestly. I was just like, she would probably think they just don't want me on the show. So that wasn't the case. But unfortunately, we went on this road and we ran into difficulties right off the offset. We have her on the line and we're working on this thing for half an hour. So eventually we come up with a process to get everybody recorded. The problem was, in order to record my track and also listen to everybody, and we were talking on cell phones and it was crazy.
It was so complex trying to get us all connected. Yeah.
I couldn't monitor my audio track with my headphones, which is what I'm doing right now. And without that, and I'm just staring into a cell phone and having a little earbud in my ear just so I can hear what's going on in the conversation and trusting everything's recording okay, my audio track was blown out because the mics are very sensitive. And what you may not realize is I'm not talking very loud right now, but if I can't monitor myself and I'm talking into a speaker of a cell phone, I'm going to yell into the cell phone. It's how it sounds like if you listen to that episode. I sound like a freak. And so, you know, when the taping was over, and it was hard, it was very hard. We didn't get to really prep Sarah, and which we tried to do.
And we had a delay. There was a slight delay in the phone call. There was, from a technical aspect, it was a mess. So hopefully this one isn't, because we're trying out a new system.
Well,
today.
It won't be. Trust me. I can already tell it's going better already. But I have to send my apologies because, you know, Sarah comes on the show and then like what happens is a day later, I get to listen to these audio tracks and I'm horrified. I actually didn't think I could even use the tracks. And I had to do a lot of things just to make my audio sound not really presentable, but and not even acceptable, but like, okay, we're still going to do an episode. But this was after I sent messages to you and Sarah saying, I think this is off. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure that Sarah was pretty upset.
So anyhow, apologies to Sarah for our technical difficulties. And we have it worked out now. So future guest, we shouldn't have to go through this kind of ordeal.
Yeah. We wouldn't have to spend 5 minutes on apologizing for that. So,
so please, if you were thinking of coming on the show, don't let this scare you off.
Right. Don't listen to the Joker and think, boy, who are these jokers who don't know how to record a podcast? We were learning. Okay. So just a little bit on this Joker. The controversies are still there, but it's kind of dying down a little bit.
The controversies, yeah. I mean, of course, it was that always happens. You know, the week or two, or even after the week or two, something controversial happens. It dies out pretty quickly, and you know, then people. And it's actually good that it came out in September, because if there is any Oscar consideration, the controversy will have died down by that.
And so, you know, and it's making a ton of money. I mean, way more money than even I thought it would make.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rated R.
Yeah, I didn't think it would be this big a hit.
Yeah, and it just shows you that, you know, people are interested when there's controversy or there's something different, and then people hear the performance is great and all that stuff. However, there's a different controversy that I wanted to bring up, and it's still going, and it actually increased recently. And that is that, you know, Martin Scorsese, the great Martin Scorsese.
Oh, this controversy. Okay, yeah. Sign me up for this.
Okay. So, you know, he's making the rounds because he's got his new movie coming out, The Irishman, and I'm pretty excited about that. And I know that I get to see it either way because I have Netflix, and that'll be on Netflix, though I really am hoping that I can see it in the theater. That's what I'm hoping, but I don't know if that'll happen.
There's a movie out right now. I'm just going to derail this for a few seconds.
Okay. I'm coming back to it. So
we're coming back, but, just thinking about seeing stuff it made me think of a Gemini Man.
Ooh. Yeah.
Which is supposed to be not a very good movie, but it uses this same de-aging technology as The Irishman.
Yes.
And it was shot at 120 frames a second. If I had the opportunity to see it at 120 frames a second, I would do it.
Okay. You know what? It's funny. You know me. I do dig these technological things.
Yes. That's why I thought you might be into this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I wasn't planning on telling you this story, but it's playing in only two theaters in the country at the 120 frames per second.
Right.
And I don't know if that's exactly the same or more or less than the Billy Lynn's Long Walk Home.
I think it might be less, actually.
No, I think it's more.
Oh, really?
Okay. I think so. I mean, it may, you know, but it's a lot. And I'd like to see, even if it's a failure, I want to see that technology looks like. However, some theaters, and more than usual, because Billy Lynn, you couldn't get it even in like the 48 frames, which I think, I think that was what the Lord of the Rings there, when he did The Hobbits.
The Hobbit series was 48.
And yeah. I found theaters to see those movies in the 48 frames.
Yeah.
And the 3D was the best, clearest 3D I've seen. However, it was a weird experience.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, I'd just like to see something more. So there's a theater that's about an hour and 40 minutes north of me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was playing The Gemini Man in 60 frames.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, you know, kind of like it wasn't quite the, 120 frames, but,
right.
but yeah, half of that. And that still would be very sharp, right?
Yeah.
And my wife was away on a business trip the weekend it came out. And I offered my sons, I said, hey, you know, if you want this weekend, we could take a little drive up north and see it. They weren't buying it. I tried the example. Like, they're like, no. And I said, well, we could watch the preview. And we started watching the trailer. They're like, yeah, no, we're going to skip it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go see it in 60 frames because I thought we could talk about it and what it was like. And you know, my kids derailed me. And so I think that if I really, really wanted to see the movie, I would have gone even by myself. But it just doesn't look that good.
Well, it's a totally mediocre movie. It's just the technology that's interesting about it. And I think if you can't see it at 120 frames or even 60, there's no point in seeing it. I won't even watch it at home because who cares?
I watched the Billy Lynn when it was on home video. That movie was a train wreck.
Yeah, I'm not. I have no interest in seeing that.
Yeah. So I mean, Ang Lee, he's interesting because he'll take any challenge and he'll do things.
Yeah.
And he either succeeds like majorly or he fails spectacularly.
And yes, he's got some spectacular failures. Absolutely.
You know, it's too bad that when he did Life of Pi, that would have been the movie to do this experiment with.
Well, yeah, but he did the 3D there, and it was really successful.
Yeah, but it was, I mean, there was where the technology enhanced a story that was great,
right.
And the whole movie was good, and you could watch that film without the 3D, though I did see it with the 3D, and it was one of the best 3D movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, so, you know, until Avatar 5.
Avatar 5. Is Cameron still alive? It's amazing that it's been 10 years now since Avatar, and this guy hasn't made anything since then.
He's just making these. But what's interesting to me is that Avatar set off the whole 3D thing.
Yes.
And it was huge for a couple of years. Yes. And they were, you know, converted. There were 3D conversions and everything had to be in 3D. And it's kind of died down a little bit. I mean, there is still 3D, but it's not quite at the level it was where everything had to be in 3D.
Yeah, essentially, studios like the uptick it does in the box office, but they force the theaters to show it. I know the theater that is up the street for me, the crappy one.
Yeah.
I asked them once, they would prefer not to show any 3D, but they have to show so many showings a week when the 3D comes out. They're like contracted to do that.
Interesting. Okay. I have never seen a 3D movie at my local theater.
Have you ever seen any 3D movies? I mean, you're not, you haven't even gone to IMAX, right?
I saw one of the Star Wars movies in 3D.
Yeah.
But, and I did go to see The Lion King in 3D. Remember like 5 years ago when that came out?
Oh, you mean the cartoon?
Yes, they did the cartoon in 3D, and I went to see that. This was maybe like 8 years ago, and my daughter flipped out. The 3D Scar was too scary, and we left the theater.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying, though, is aside from maybe this Gemini Man, there's really been no filmmaker in the last, like, I don't know, 6-7 years that has put any thought into the 3D process and kind of made a film where the 3D aspect, the last movie that I saw, aside from Life of Pi, that anybody really put any attention to was Martin Scorsese doing Hugo. And it was...
I knew that's what... I almost interrupted you with Hugo.
But, well, that's because I'm getting back to the Scorsese. It really was the absolute best 3D I've ever seen, because you had a true filmmaker saying, okay, this technology, what do I do with it? How do I tell
a
story?
How do I use it to tell a story? Yeah.
So back to this controversy is that he's got the Irishman out. He's doing the talk circuits. And of course, somebody asks him, well, what do you think of these Marvel movies, right? So what is he going to say? Of course, he's like, you know, he doesn't, he says what it, an honest answer. Now, I think people just misinterpret what it means, but he says, you know, they're not cinema.
Right.
And suddenly everybody's taking offense, the fanboys, the filmmakers of these movies, right? The James Gunn and all that. And, you know, like, calm down, people. Okay? Because you know it and we know it. They aren't cinema. They're amusement park rides.
Well, it's...
They are. They happen to be in a cinema, I guess.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you, but it's not... I don't think what Scorsese is doing is taking... I don't think he's being a snob.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. These are just pure entertainments. They are rides. They're an experience. I mean, they're not even an experience, you know? That would almost make them too pure cinema, and they're not.
Well, they're a formula, they're a genre. I mean, that's the thing is, superhero movies are now a genre.
It's absolutely a genre. It would be interesting if it was really more like an amusement park ride, actually. But so many of these superhero movies have scenes, endless scenes of people standing around talking. This is my big problem with Joss Whedon, that first Avengers movie, is it was just terrible. It was shot like a TV show. There was no cinematic value to it whatsoever, and it just had people standing around having boring conversations. And then, like, a big CGI, I mean, why watch that when you could play a video game? Video games are much better.
Well, I'll take the Pepsi challenge with that over Age of Ultron, which was, like, really bad. And the thing is, we see now, if you really stretch all of those films out and you really take a good look at them, I would say 75% to 80% of them are terrible. And then the 20%, you know, they're enjoyable, but there's not really one of them that I walk away from with any lasting memories.
I think my favorite one out of all the Marvel movies is the first Guardians of the Galaxy.
I loved it. I did. I enjoyed it. And I thought I had a good story. And it was, of course, you know, the building of a team, and there was the fun and the characters. And then the second movie already kind of fell into that trap of, you know, they, instead of them all together, it's like, let's split them apart. And it starts to feel like, oh, the real reason why they're split apart is because it probably cost less in actor salaries,
right?
Which is what we talked about with that awful last Avengers movie, which, yes, it made the most money of all time and, you know, all this other crap. But nobody wants to address the fact that it's kind of a boring movie. And I could care less. And when it was over, it was like, eh. And I never want to watch it a second time.
Right. And I've seen Guardians of the Galaxy several times.
I've seen that a good 3 or 4 times, yes.
Yeah, me too. My kids like it. But even, I would have to say, the first Iron Man movie, which sort of started this whole thing, doesn't really hold up for me.
Well, the problem is, like, the end, which looked like they wrote on the fly, it's kind of introduced that big, overblown action scene that's just kind of boring. The rest of the movie's way more entertaining, him building the Iron Man suit and figuring out the technologies. And then, obviously, you know, there's the whole aspect of whether or not, you know, can he survive without the technology kind of thing. But then having the boss who's really, like, you know, evil or whatever, and he turns into that big robotic thing, that part's a little weak. And then, of course, the rest of those Iron Man movies are terrible.
Right. Yeah. Even the Shane Black one, which I had high hopes for, because...
No, it's terrible.
It's terrible. It's terrible. I was so hopeful about that movie after Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And
it's filled with a lot of yucks.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, that's the thing. When you talk about these characters that are all standing around, basically they're like, how many fun little scenes where everybody gets to say something funny that, that an audience can laugh at?
Exactly. Everybody gets sort of a couple of clever character-defining lines.
Now, look, even though I'm knocking them, they're not for me, and they're not for Martin Scorsese. And guess who else they're not for? They're not for Francis Ford Coppola, who came to Scorsese's defense, and now
he's in trouble. Yeah, what did he say? Because I haven't seen his quote. Do you have it in?
I don't remember the quote, but he was essentially kind of agreeing with Scorsese, but even more so saying that these movies are kind of a waste of time. and he just okay. has, and he doesn't so like
not
them
only did he come to his defense,
yeah, he upped the ante. And that's the thing is, you know, and then of course people want to, you know, crap on Coppola, like, when's the last time you made a good movie? And they may have a point, but
no, they have no point.
Well, I think they have a point that, yeah, he hasn't made a good movie in a while, but what I think he's lamenting the fact is that the kind of cinema that interested him,
yeah,
they don't make anymore. And so he can't get his ideas funded. And, you know, they came from a decade where people could put the stories they wanted to on screen and audiences went to watch them. And now they don't go out to the theater to watch those stories as much. They, you know, watch these binge-worthy TVs, which have their own sort of ups and downs.
Well, everything is so designed now for focus groups almost and for audiences. And I think, yeah, that decade that you're talking about, the 70s with Coppola and Scorsese, is what would happen is movie studios would just say, hey, this sounds like a good movie, let's make it. Like, literally, that was the decision-making process. And now it's all about analyzing market share and, you know, quarterly return. It's a very different corporate environment, and that's reflected in the product we see. We get we get these things that are much more designed to be four quadrant movies for the international market, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's another thing I was going to mention last week we didn't get to, which is probably good because my voice was so bad I would have cut it out. but, you know, these Disney, which owns Marvel and pretty much everything, yeah. Part of this formula is feeding the monkey, as they say, is making
Wait,
sure.
Who says feeding the monkey?
What was that thing? You got to feed the monkey. I guess that's like Lebowski says that.
Okay.
You know, the trophy wife in the parlance of our time owes right. money all over town, and she's got to feed the monkey. Man,
she's got to feed the monkey.
No, is that the most important part and why the, say, Avengers was able to become the, you know, biggest box office success right. as far as, you know, modern money goes, is the fact that a large chunk of that money comes from China. And
yes, that's what I was getting at.
And they basically have to make these films so that they can be, you know, pretty much off the box, ready for the Chinese market, and will not face the scrutiny of the censors, or that they can be willing to cut things left and right. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, South Park, which is always doing a satire, did this thing where one of the characters is trying to increase his weed farm business, and he gets this bright idea that he's going to go to China and sell his weed because it's a big open market there, right? So he gets on this plane and he discovers that everybody on the plane is trying to do business and sell something to China. And he runs into all these superheroes. He runs into like Thor and all these characters. And basically because Disney has such a tie-in, and basically over in China, not only do they arrest this character right away for trying to sell weed.
Right.
But he goes into prison and he's there with Winnie the Pooh, because supposedly there was this rumor that Winnie the Pooh looks like the Chinese president or something. So they banned Winnie the Pooh. And it makes this really strong connection to how Disney will feed this wealth engine to the Chinese right. market, and that what happens is that these movies are censored before they even get made. And so you're just getting this homogenous crap that won't offend anybody.
Well, and it's also, there's some strange cultural things that go on. Like in China, I don't know if this is actually codified or not, but you're not supposed to show supernatural things or ghosts in movies.
Hmm.
Have you heard this before?
No.
Okay.
No, but guess what? You know, Bruce Lee's daughter filed a complaint, a formal complaint with China. It's like her act of revenge against Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. at her father's portrayal in it. So China said, sorry, you can't show Once Upon a Time in Hollywood unless you make some cuts for us. And Quentin Tarantino said, well, I guess you don't get my movie.
Yeah, exactly. But movies are cut. There are special China cuts of some movies. I think Iron Man 3, actually, I think has more China stuff.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. They'll actually create plot lines, right, and stuff.
Oh, yeah. So they can actually shoot in China or, you know, one of your favorite films.
Oh, which one?
The Meg.
Megalodon. Yeah, we did talk about that.
We did, but that's very definitely designed for the international market.
And look, I get it. And I think that it can be a great business strategy, but it goes along with Scorsese's argument that says these things are products. They're not cinema.
Right. They're not art. They're a product.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, I think this is why The Joker, whether you liked it or hate it, why this is getting people into the theaters is they recognize that, well, geez, it's familiar because I see a comic book character, but wait a minute, this isn't what I normally get. And that's exciting to a lot of people who literally haven't seen anything like The Joker, even though it's really a homage to many other films.
It is. Yeah. I wonder how many people on opening weekend really just had no idea what they were getting into and just thought, oh, it's another superhero movie.
Well, I mean, I think that was some of the points that Sarah made that were fascinating. Yeah. Is that she really wouldn't have gone to see the movie, but she was curious because you saw it and you were being very evasive with your answer and she wanted to experience it. But she went in kind of not with a lot of preconceived notions and she walked away really enjoying it. So I would love to hear from some other people who literally went in thinking it was going to be one thing and was either like horrified or loved the fact that it was something else.
And I have no idea like what the audience or what the cinema score is or anything like that. The audience response, I don't know what that, but the movie's still making money.
Oh, yeah.
And it's still doing fine. But so people are going to see it. So it's, somehow it's caught on. I mean, it's made $250 million domestic.
Yeah, but it's made almost $800 million total worldwide. That's an insane number. For a rated R film, I mean, wow. So, you know, kudos. And, you know, the good news is there's a mainstream film that I think operates, as Sarah said last week, as almost like a French New Wave film.
Yeah. Well, and going back to Scorsese's argument, it is cinema.
Absolutely. I wonder if he'll see that. I mean, it's tied in with so many of his films, and that's probably why he asked it.
No, he almost produced it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He did.
Yeah, he was going to be the producer at one point.
But that doesn't mean he's watched it.
No, but it means he's aware of it.
Right. And I can see why he was probably interested, because it does tie into a lot of those themes, right, that he did. But here's the good news is that there's a lot of films, and there's some smaller ones, but they're making their way out there. And just in a small scale level right now, they're doing very well. And I'm hoping that they might come around to where I am, because I really want to see them, is this movie Parasite.
Oh, yes. Yes.
One of our listener friends actually saw it and has already been raving about it. And The Lighthouse.
Yes.
Which I
absolutely want to see The Lighthouse.
I have a small window this weekend. I'm going to be someplace where The Lighthouse will be playing. I don't think I'm going to get there, but I'm going to certainly try.
Oh, it's opening this week?
I think it's open in a few theaters, but it's opening a little bit wider this weekend, and I'm going to be in Massachusetts, and it's going to be playing in Boston and Somerville, and it's my window where I might be able to see it is very small. So if I can see it, man, I really, really, I can't be satisfied with seeing that on the small screen. I want to see that in the theater because, you know, it's that 1:3:3 aspect ratio. Yeah. If it's shown in a big screen, black and white, I just got to see it.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, my theater is really bad about telling us what's coming next. So,
right, it's a surprise. Hey,
and you know, and I go and I look at what's playing now, and there's nothing I want to see.
You know, my theater is playing. I give them credit. I can't get there, unfortunately, to see it, I don't think. But I would have liked to have, if I had the time, was the Renee Zellweger, Judy Garland movie there. Judy?
Yeah.
I know. It looks like Lifetime, but...
That's fine to watch at home.
I know. But I figured, you know, I like to see these movies that are in consideration and then we can talk about them and, you know.
That's true. Yeah.
So I don't think I'm going to see that, but it's out there for at least a week at my local theater.
Okay.
I was surprised. Well, I didn't think they would. Yeah. I didn't think they had the Stones, man. they do get some of the named ones, I have to say, but they're not going to get The Lighthouse. I just would be shocked.
Yeah, I well, you know, unless somehow it turns into a hit.
Yeah. Well, they did get Midsommar.
Yeah.
You know, but
The Witch played here.
And The Witch did play here, but that's different. That was a regular, you know, aspect ratio, and it was in color. Black and white might be too much for this local theater, because there'll be somebody that'll come out and go, why is there no color in this movie? Is that supposed to be like that? Why is the screen like, because, you know, they don't have the mat. They won't bring the curtains
right, they
in.
They won't mat it.
So yeah. They'll be like, I know the preview showed everything, but I saw the trailers, but now this movie's only a square. Yeah, I don't think they want that aggravation. Hey, but you know, so
theaters actually make booking choices based on how annoyed people will be about the movie.
Yeah.
Why does it have words on it? I don't understand what they're talking about.
Subtitles? What? I mean, I just, you know, I think that my local area, there's more sophisticated moviegoers than this particular theater gives it credit. And it's just unfortunate that, remember when I went out of my way to see
Cold War?
To see Cold War, which was another 133 and black and white. Well, that theater, it closed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they lost their lease due to like, you know, some big box store that wanted to move right into the town. And the good news is that they're committed to wanting to bring this. They just realized that there's just more that they want to do than just have the two screens that they have. And if they could just get the right venue and be able to have a multiplex, they could show.
So they're not, they're just reforming their business.
Well, yeah, they'd like to. I'm just saying it right could take them a few years. I mean, where I live, a few years is like a minute in history, you know, just whether I'm going to still be here for all that. So, you know, We kind of talked about Marvel more than I would like to.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe we should just say, I think we may have mentioned this in an earlier episode, but when we first started doing the show, we had sort of an unwritten rule, which was that we don't talk about Marvel movies. Yeah.
But you know what, though, to the credit, that there's been more interesting topics to talk about than we ever thought there would be.
Right, but that one of the reasons we didn't want to talk about Marvel movies is in my opinion anyway, is because they're not cinema and because they're products, and therefore I feel like they're critic proof.
Send your complaints to feedback@jimandteal.com. Bring your scorn.
Yeah, but I just feel like they're not worth talking about because they're just exactly what they are, and there's nothing really that much to say about them. And I think Scorsese's right. So send your complaints. Absolutely. I'll fight Marvel fanboys.
By the way, on that topic, right? Because again, I still feel like if you love those movies, that's so fine. No one's saying that you're like a less of a person because you love those
right
movies. Obviously,
right,
millions do. But there's a critic, and you mentioned her a few weeks ago, what, Stephanie Zacharek?
Zacharek. Yeah,
I don't remember. Sorry, her name Stephanie. Again. I know you're an avid listener.
But she writes for Time.
Yeah. And she used to write for other sites. And
yeah.
So she has like met with tons of fan abuse because mm-hmm she dared to write a big pan of Joker. I think her problem isn't just that she panned the Joker, but then she's like kept on fueling the flames with like every time she could mention anything negative about it. Now, I don't happen to share her opinion, but you know, she's a critic and you need people that like aren't going to, I don't want to like universal praise of something.
Right.
She just, as you said, the Rorschach test is that everybody gets a different opinion when they see a movie like that. And so,
yeah,
okay, she's allowed to not like it. You don't have to jump on her because she didn't think it was the greatest movie of all time, you know?
Well, and I thought she made a pretty coherent argument. I just disagreed with it.
Yeah,
but
and that's the thing is we went from disagreeing about things to like, now it's either my way or the highway.
Well, yeah, it's become as polarized as everything else. Our pop culture is just as rife with conflict as our politics.
You know what I say, Twitter? Just say no.
Yeah.
You know what would be very interesting? If, like, if I had a big bag of money, I would buy...
Well, if we're going to start that conversation.
Yeah, well, if I had a big bag of money that I, and all the other things I'd buy first, and of course I'd set up with a nice home theater setup, of course, and you know, and a print... film print library. But anyways, but after all that, after all that, I would purchase Twitter, right? Because I had so much, because I have a big bag of money and I can purchase
it. That's a pretty, pretty damn big bag of money.
All right. I don't know how much it would cost, but like, you know, nobody wanted, but nobody wanted to buy them before because, you know, it's a losing proposition. They don't make, they don't make any money. They don't. So I'd buy it, right? Because my bag is big enough to still have billions afterwards. And as soon as I bought it, I would just shut it down. I'd give everybody a good severance package, and then I'd shut it down immediately. Imagine what would happen. See, it, of course, something would replace it eventually.
It would be replaced instantly.
No, it couldn't be, though. You can't just – it takes a while to build all that up. I'm guaranteeing you it wouldn't. We'd shut it down. Yep. All the negativity. People wouldn't know it. Some people would be thrilled. It would be like the chains came off and they'd be like, oh, thank God. I don't have to, like, you know, take my innermost demonic thoughts and then put them out there and then instantly regret it as it follows my career for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And there is definitely in the fanboyism and the just in pop culture, there's definitely, there's a lot of anger that's gets expressed on Twitter towards, you know, people who don't like what you like.
Yeah, I really don't look at Twitter too often anymore because it's really, it's not a friendly place. It isn't. I mean, so, I get some news and stuff, but, you know.
Okay, so let's change gears a little bit.
You're like, let's get out of that lane.
Yeah,
I'm steering you out
of the Twitter lane because I sense that it's, like Twitter itself, a dead end.
Oh, good times.
So here, I had something I want to ask you about.
Oh, okay.
You watched recently, you told me, some Herschel Gordon Lewis movies, or at least one.
Yes. Why don't you tell, for people who don't know who Herschel Gordon Lewis is, he's maybe not as familiar unless you're really into cinema.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So Herschel Gordon Lewis, sort of a low budget sub Roger Corman.
Yes. Sub. Yes.
Sub. Like if you look at Corman as sort of like the cheap drive in, make a quick buck director, Herschel Gordon Lewis is below that.
Well, you know what it was? Is, if you think of like William Castle, who made all those like low budget quickie horror films,
yes,
came up with a lot of gimmicks to try to get people in the audience, but then he also had to take his films and he went from town to town.
Yes.
And, you know, try to book theaters and make money that way. Never going to make, you know, rich, but that's what he did. Well, Herschel Gordon Lewis, he took that sort of approach and he made his own films and took them from town to town.
Yeah.
But he decided that he would give audiences something that mainstream cinemas,
yes,
couldn't give, wouldn't give, and shouldn't give, was basically take exploitation levels to like a new high. And he is really kind of the grandfather in many ways, at least in terms of horror and shock, of grindhouse movies.
Well, and of body horror and gore.
He
pushed gore to its limit for what was beyond what was acceptable at the time.
Well, yeah, because Blood Feast, right? This is the one. And this is the one I watched because Criterion Channel has a little offering of some of his films, which I had never seen any of his films.
Right.
And so they have Blood Feast, but this was 1962 and he shot it in color because he really wanted to shock audiences with
yes,
the very vibrant color. And the what I can really say is I'm sure that John Waters was influenced by this guy because
that makes sense.
The schlocky approach and just the really stagnant acting and the line delivery and the dialogue, it feels like John Waters watched these movies much differently than other audiences and thought they were a hoot.
Right.
Because it was hilarious. Like what I watched over a series of days, like right before bed, we'd watch like 15 minutes. It is so ridiculous. And the lines of dialogue and the way the actors read them and just the camera setups. This guy had no filmmaking style whatsoever.
No, none at all. Just put a camera there and film what's in front of it without any real thought to framing or anything.
Yeah, I think he probably got excited when he's like, oh, and I'll go in for one sort of medium shot. I'll do a scene twice. And I think that the great Anna Biller probably was influenced by this movie Blood Feast 2, and also this other film that I'm sort of in the middle of. It's from the early 70s. It's called The Wizard of Gore, and it's almost like the same type of film. But just in the lighting style and the kitschy approach to the dialogue, it does have a Love Witch feel, and also this movie that she also made called Viva.
Okay, that's very interesting. Yeah, well, I think that makes sense, right? Yeah, she does have that stagey kind of feel.
Yeah, and I actually was trying, when I watched those movies, I was like, oh, these are definitely throwbacks to these other types of films, but I really didn't have the film knowledge to know exactly what were those movies. And then I see a film like Blood Feast and The Wizard of Gore, and I'm like, oh, well, these are two of those movies. that have that approach. So, you know, as a horror film, I mean, certainly today, it's not that they're tame. They're kind of just lame. So you see all this gore, but it's so ridiculous. I mean, the blood looks so fake, and it's just so over the top. And I just wish I could kind of transport myself back into 1962 and see it with an audience that might have viewed it much differently.
Right, and would have been totally horrified by it. Yeah, so I first saw some of these movies in the 80s.
Right, on video, right?
On video, yeah.
And they must have been crappy copies.
Oh, terrible, yeah.
These were probably the best that these movies have ever looked.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. Yeah, they were crappy copies, but, you know, I was into horror movies, and I had some friends that were into horror movies, and they sort of turned me on to it. And I think also, I think the thing that first got me interested in Herschel Gordon Lewis was, I think his influence can most be seen in Tom Savini.
Well, sure. That's probably when he saw those films and said, I want to make movies like this, or I want to be able to make effects like that.
Exactly. And Tom Savini did the special makeup effects for Dawn of the Dead and a bunch of 80s horror movies. And
Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Yeah. The list goes on and on. But he did something called special makeup effects, which was basically body horror and gore. Done with like latex and rubber and fake blood. And Herschel Gordon Lewis sort of pioneered that type of movie and that type of special effects. And for the 80s, really up until up until Jurassic Park, I would say that the special effects in horror movies were not digital. They were all this kind of special makeup effect stuff.
Well, yeah, you needed those Savinis, the Rick Bakers, the Rob Bottins. I mean, these people were, well, to you and I, they were like these effects gods.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But they were really, I mean, not that digital isn't, but these were real artists in the old sense, right? You know, they were sculptors, they were painters.
Yeah, they had to be big problem solvers, but they couldn't solve it through, what can I do with some computer software?
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, these guys, especially Savini, how I got into horror movies and really was fascinated was from that aspect. It wasn't like, oh, I want to see gore. It was, I want to see what these makeup artists created. You know, one time I went, when we'd have to go accompany my mom, my sister and I, to the drugstore, we would go and they would go off and do whatever. But I went to the magazine aisle. And I discovered Fangoria magazine.
Yeah.
And every time we'd go, I would just look at that cover to cover. Occasionally, I would just, I started buying it and eventually got a subscription. But I was just so fascinated. And then I would see what movies were coming out and would see these like selected gore effects. And then there'd be interviews with the makeup artists. And that's how I got my dad to start taking me to these movies. I don't know if it was even so much with like, oh, he really likes horror movies. They liked the fact that he was so fascinated in the process and that maybe he wants to go into makeup effects. I don't know. So we should take him to see these movies.
Yeah. So this is something we really share, I think, this 1980s love of Fangoria magazine. And Yeah, there, like you said, there were interviews with people, like, and then you would, I would want to see the movie just to see the special effects.
I saw so many bad horror movies solely based on wanting to see those effect scenes.
Yes, absolutely. And so my experience with this was that I, as a kid, up until I was maybe about 13, I was terrified of horror movies. I had seen Alien, and that deeply disturbed me. Hmm. And I, you know, wasn't this severe, but basically I, you know, when they talk about fainting at the sight of blood, it really, like, blood really freaked me out.
I remember this about you.
Yeah. And I couldn't deal with it as a kid at all. Any kind of gore was, like, totally traumatic to me. And then I saw Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah. You would mention that way early. Like, so
yeah.
If you're a, you know, new listener, you didn't hear that if you hadn't go early episodes, but almost a year ago is when we started the program.
Is when we started. And I did mention that, but yeah, that, and that got me interested in special makeup effects and sort of my love of 80s horror.
Well, probably because it wasn't so much you were scared of the blood as now you're fascinated by somebody had to create, this isn't real. Exactly. I know it's not real. How did they make this?
Yeah, how do they make this happen? Because it's so over the top, that shotgun blast to the head.
Yep.
And it's like, I had never seen anything like it. And it was amazing to me that somebody had to create all that stuff. And I, like you, I thought maybe this is what I want to do when I grow up. Good thing I didn't choose that, since it doesn't exist anymore.
Pretty much no. And they don't even show that show Face Off anymore, which had makeup artists trying to win a prize. So that right. was an outlet for makeup artists that doesn't exist either.
Yeah, because I think I think there are still some special effects.
It's just not, those premier horror movies that relied on a really cool, you know, makeup creature or effect or, you know,
yeah.
Again, Rick Baker kind of retired because there was not enough to keep him going. I think whenever he's done something, it's been, you know, a special project that called him out of retirement.
Right. Now, he did American Werewolf in London, right?
Well, yeah, that was the very first Oscar winner for best makeup.
Okay.
And they invented that category because it was so sensational. They're like, we gotta nominate that film somehow because I've never seen special effects like it.
Well, and there really hadn't been anything. I think about that scene a lot. There was late in his career, Herschel Gordon Lewis promised that he had a special effect that he was trying to do, which was to have a person torn apart on screen, limb by limb, like ripped to pieces, without any cuts.
Oh, that's interesting. Which I feel like Savini kind of did in Dawn of the Dead.
Savini comes really close to it. And yeah, so that was sort of a goal of his. And I think that's part of his cinematic style, actually, is that there aren't very many cuts.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm fascinating enough. I really do want to, I want to finish The Wizard of Gore, and I don't know if there's any others that I can watch that they've got up there, but, you know, it's just, again, it's kind of going back into my education process and seeing what some of these filmmakers on the fringes did that influenced people.
Right. Yeah. And it really did. Yeah. I mean, Herschel Gordon Lewis sort of set, without him, the whole genre of sort of probably the teen slasher movie wouldn't really exist in the same way.
Yeah. You always have to have the pioneers.
Yes.
So Criterion, they're doing, they're featuring Jean-Pierre Melville right now.
Yeah.
And they're showing every feature film he did. And I've seen several, and they're really good, but I'm watching this sort of like a heist film called Le Flic.
I've not seen it.
Yeah, it's got some cool stuff in it. So I think that's another thing, is that it's kind of great with these Criterion collections that they'll just feature a whole filmmaker, and maybe you've seen like one of their films, but it's a chance to maybe jump in and catch up on a few of them.
And some of these, Criterion is great as sort of digging these up, but they're sort of like what we've been talking about recently in Notes from the Streaming Underground.
Yes.
Is, you know, we're sort of looking, when we talk about that, we're looking for sort of movies that have come out in the last decade that are on the Streaming Underground. But these movies would have been on the Streaming Underground if there was one in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, you know, I'm kicking myself because I didn't realize these were up there and now they're going away at the end of the month. Is they were doing a Safdie Brothers retrospective and showing some of their early works.
Okay.
And they've got that new movie coming out with, what's his face there, the comedian guy.
No idea what you're talking about.
What? You know who the Safdie brothers are, right?
Yeah, but I don't keep track of like what's coming out.
All right. Well, you don't. Okay. Well, the guy, Adam Sandler. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yes.
Uncut Gems. You haven't seen the trailer for that, I bet. It looks really
good. No.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
It looks really cool. But
didn't even know it existed. Don't know what it is.
I really liked their last film with Robert Pattinson, Good Time.
Yes, that was a great film.
And so that impressed me, but I didn't know that they had these earlier films on Criterion. So I'm hoping that maybe I can eke one out before they disappear at the end of the month. And okay. Then I'm really looking forward to this Uncut Gems in December because that thing looks like gangbusters.
Okay, very cool.
Yeah. So, you know, I told you about the one horror movie that really scared me at the time,
right,
which was Texas Chainsaw. So we've already told you of that story, but I find that not too many movies really scared me, but one movie that made me very uncomfortable, mm-hmm, like it kind of was a different scary, but I remember seeing it in an original run, and my friend and I went down to Harvard Square to see it, and it came out in 86. We were still, I was only still 15, but Harvard Square was going to let us in anyway. They didn't care. It was just got more and more uncomfortable, and that's Blue Velvet.
yeah.
And so, but it's not like, I found it intense when he was in the closet at the beginning, right? And he's spying on her, and then he like sees that encounter with Frank Booth.
Right.
But what really unnerved me, unsettled me, because I really didn't know what was going to happen, was when he makes his escape one night from the, or he's coming out with her after he like introduced her, and they come out and Frank Booth is outside and he's like, who is this guy? And she's like, oh, he's Jeffrey from the neighborhood. And he's like, Jeffrey, let's go for a joyride. And he's like, I don't want to go. And he's like, go where? He's like, for a ride. He's like, a ride. Now that's a good idea.
Now that's a good idea. Yeah.
And then he gets him in that car with all his pals and they're zooming down the highway. And at that moment, my stomach was tied up in knots because I was really, really concerned about Kyle MacLachlan's character and what was going to happen to him.
That's interesting.
Because I didn't know anything about the movie. I mean, I knew like that David Lynch had this film out and critics were, you know, really enjoying it, but I didn't know the story. And so I really couldn't say that this guy was going to be safe from this encounter.
Right, right, right.
And then they go to that bar and that whole thing's very strange. And it wasn't until that was over and he was safely out of Frank Booth's clutches that my stomach was able to ease up a bit. And so it wasn't that I was scared, I don't know, but it was just so intense. And I was thinking, boy, you got to really be in the hands of a film master who can make you feel like that during a movie.
Yes. And that's, I don't know, it makes me think about what Scorsese said, actually.
About what cinema is.
About what cinema is.
I like how you tied the whole theme back.
Yeah.
We got a theme for the show.
Because that's what cinema is... something that, do you know Film Crit Hulk? Remember Film Crit Hulk?
Film Crit?
Hulk. You know, like the Hulk. The superhero.
Yeah.
Well, okay, there was this guy named Film Crit Hulk.
Okay.
Who had a Twitter account and so forth.
Twitter.
And he wrote all his film reviews in all caps in Hulk voice.
I think I do now know who this is.
Really a smart guy, works, as far as I remember, he works in the industry somehow, involving story stuff and scripts. He never came out who he actually was, but his
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney all along. But his
with
sort
a secret
of
account.
Go-to philosophy, and I've mentioned this before, but his sort of underlying philosophy of cinema is that people watch movies viscerally, not intellectually.
I think the intellectual part comes later.
Exactly. But it's hitting you when you're first sitting there in the first time you're watching it. I mean, it happens. Sometimes you are a little, can get intellectual while I'm watching. But when the movie's really working, it's that knot in your stomach. It's that where it's sort of bypassing your frontal lobe and affecting you in sort of this reptilian brain kind of way.
Well, the gestalt, everything comes together.
Exactly.
And creates a feeling.
And you have that emotional or visceral response to it. And that's what you're talking about with Blue Velvet. And that's what cinema is. And my question is, do maybe some people have that with the Marvel movies, right? Is there, I'm going to suggest no, that what they're feeling is just thrills, which is different.
Well, yeah, that's why like a theme park ride is a very good equation. I mean, if you go see a Marvel movie, which I've seen most of the ones when I've seen them, I'll see them at the IMAX because you're immersed with the sound. The seats rock. It's a huge screen. They now shoot them on, you know, on the Alexa 65 and they frame it with, you know, the IMAX experience in mind. So for the IMAX version, it will be full screen and it's actually been framed that way. You know, it's kind of like how when people would frame in the 70s, they would also frame it for TV so that the good stuff doesn't get cut off. So it's kind of like that, but like, you know, it's a bit of a rush. And at the end, you feel like, yeah, that was awesome. But then it quickly fades and you don't really think about it.
Well, because, and getting back to Blue Velvet, what you're talking about in Blue Velvet is a very complicated emotional response, right? Because you're thrilled, you're afraid, you're going into the unknown, you maybe even want to laugh a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's uncomfortable laughter. He puts you in a closet to be a voyeur, and you know you're not supposed to be in there. You know, see, that's the thing is, it's no longer just Kyle MacLachlan shouldn't be in there watching her. You are in there watching her.
Exactly, and you shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, that's a masterful movie. And I know we're just kind of touching on there. I don't know where, you know, Glenn, I'm glad you tied it in because I wasn't necessarily getting it back to where it probably should be. And we're really running low on time for this program. So
we probably should be finishing up the program and we'll probably come back to this again. But if something is cinema, it's doing something that involves you viscerally and probably even morally. And engages you in something fairly complex that is cinema. It's something that's complex, it's contradictory, it's layered, and you're not getting a lot of layers out of these Marvel movies. You're getting a roller coaster ride, like you said, which does provide thrills.
Spider-Man Far From Home, not cinema. Joker, cinema.
Exactly.
There we go. All right. So, hey, everyone, or people, whoever's out there, thanks for listening. And I hope that this has been a much better sounding experience. Please let us know at feedback@jimandteal.com. And certainly, if you haven't already, subscribe to us on the Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Leave a rating, leave a comment, or catch us on our website, stuffweveseen.com. You can always leave a comment there. And we always appreciate the feedback. And we love hearing from you. And we do hear from some of you, so that's great too.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Thank you, Teal. And hopefully you can bump up those bro supporters to 5 out of 5 by next program.
Wait, you mean Marvel bros?
Marvel, 3 out of 5 Marvel bros approve of Teal. And 1 out of 5 approve of me. Yep. All right.
All right.
Later, gang. Go see some stuff.
Bye.